Hey everyone, just a heads up that this episode does have a mention of suicide. That's at around minute 48, so if you'd like to skip that, you should be able to come back in at minute 50 just to be safe. Please take care of yourself and thanks for listening.
Is this thing on?
I'm Karen.
And I'm Challen.
Welcome to Queer Air Season 2, a podcast where we, two library grad students at the University of Washington, take a deep dive into the archives and give you a breath of fresh queer air.
Hi, Karen. How's it going?
I'm doing well, Challen. It's getting really summery out here. I've been laying out on the ground like a lizard, which is my ideal state. So I'm feeling pretty good. And I'm excited to celebrate some fun things with you this weekend.
Yeah, it's my birthday on Monday, May 17th, even though this will most likely come out way after. but I'm very excited. We're gonna go see a drag show, so that'll be fun.
Yes, and it's gonna be like my first time out having fun since like ever, so I'm gonna be very excited and have a lot of small dog energy, I can already tell.
Yeah, I guess in other parts of my life, I'm also really excited the new Saw movie, Spiral, comes out on the 14th.
What?
So you best believe that I will be watching Saw every single day in the theaters this weekend for my birthday to myself. So I'm very excited for that. The Saw franchise is my second favorite franchise ever in the history of franchises. My first is the Twilight series, and my third is the Kill Bill.
Oh my God.
Franchise. So if you want to know my taste, that's my taste. So I've been watching a lot of Legendary lately, which is a reality TV competition show on HBO Max. Highly recommend it. It's about a bunch of different houses from the ball scene doing voguing and competing to become the superior house. It's really great because it, you know, showcases a lot of queer talent, a lot of trans talent, a lot of people of color, and just does like a really excellent job at like highlighting ball culture, because ball culture is literally like the birthplace of every single like pop culture moment ever. You know, like everything originates from ball culture, and we need to, you know, celebrate these Black and Latinx trans women who literally have just single-handedly, you know, created everything that's correct in the world. So snaps to them. Also, Pose season 3 came out a couple weeks ago. I have not watched it yet because it's a lot to handle for me emotionally. So I'm waiting for the right moment.
You're like the hungry caterpillar, Challen. You just like bring all these delicious things to my table and I am super happy to partake. So that's awesome. Yeah, I guess I'll just say, because I can't not bring it up. My favorite franchise is the Fast and Furious franchise.
Yes.
I'm just gonna leave it at that. I guess now I should lead us through our land acknowledgement. So this kind of came up when we were doing our latest recordings. I realized that a lot of the records that we're handling mention, or maybe don't mention, being on Indigenous land. And I use this Native land resource, which I'll put in our description.
I want to share the link. It's native-land.ca.
Basically, you enter your address and it tells you whose land you're on. We're on the traditional lands of the Coast Salish, Duwamish, Stillaguamish, and Suquamish. But I did my best and cobbled together something that I think will serve for Queer Air Season 2 as far as we are today. We, the hosts of Queer Air, would like to acknowledge that we are on the land of the First Peoples of Seattle. We could not live here or do this work without them. In particular, we recognize the ongoing sacrifices and contributions of the Duwamish people, past and present. In many ways, we have benefited from injustices and inequities done to them, past and present. We intend to grapple with this ourselves and support the justice that the Duwamish tribe pursues. And finally, we honor with gratitude the land itself and the Duwamish tribe. So that is all to say this process led me through a lot of reflection. And I just had some questions for you and I to consider, Chalyn, just because we're introducing this land acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. The first one is just asking, like, how did we come to be here where we are today, like physically recording this podcast? And, you know, what does being here in Seattle mean to us?
Yeah, that's a good question. I came here from Carson City, Nevada, which is on the lands of the Paiute people and also the Washoe people. Yeah, I think it's also just important to like do these land acknowledgements because it just always, you know, reminds me that like whenever I'm walking around and, you know, driving to different places that the land that I'm on is stolen and was colonized, mm-hmm. and also just giving space to these Native peoples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, thanks for bringing all that up. I guess to answer the same question, yes, I have also come from actually the Southwest, like Chalyn. So I'm from Tucson, Arizona, and that is traditionally the land of the Tohono O'odham people. I think it's really important for us to do these acknowledgments to kind of interrupt those common scripts that we probably often hear of like defensiveness or guilt, or just rattling off this sentence without any sort of engagement with it. And I think all of that work just, you know, disrupts those dominant processes, highlights ongoing injustices. And it's also just like healthy for us to show gratitude to the land and the people of this land. So
yeah, thank you so much for that, Karen. I appreciate you leading that. This episode, we are talking about the Alice B. Theater, which was a queer theater here in Seattle. And more specifically, we're going to be talking about their play, Hidden History, True Stories from Seattle's Gay and Lesbian Elders. It was written by Drew Emery and the rest of the cast who were a part of it. I pulled a lot of this from the Stephen Blair Papers, which you might have remembered from episode 2. It was specifically from a season program that they had. Alice B. Theater's roots stem back to 1984 when Rick Rankin, a quote-unquote performing maverick, founded Gay Theater Seattle, which hosted the annual Gay and Lesbian Theater Festival. In 1985, during its second annual festival, the Seattle Times gave positive reviews of the performance, and the festival quickly became a popular attraction for out-and-proud queer art. Gay Theater Seattle was disbanded in 1986, 2 years after its creation, and was reorganized as the Alice B. Theater with Rankin and Susan Fink, a noted director and performer at the time, as its co-founders. The theater's name is also in honor of Alice B. Toklas, the lover slash editor slash publisher of Gertrude Stein, who is a Jewish lesbian novelist, playwright, and poet, and was also a big person in the modernist movement back in the day. Yeah, so Alice B. Theater quickly became known and respected for producing work that would, quote unquote, tell the stories of lesbians and gays with respect, dignity, and often humor, and presented more than 90 shows during their run. In 1991, Alice B. Theater was awarded a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts and continued to receive funding from both national and regional foundations. In 1994, both Rankin and Fink, the original founders, left the theater to pursue other projects and hired on Andrew J. Mellon as the artistic director. And now the rest of this history comes from a Seattle Times article in 1997 called Curtain Calls for Alice B. Theater. The theater started accruing some major debt during the early 1990s. The recently hired artistic director, Andrew Mellon, was let go in 1996 because the company could not afford to pay him. He was replaced by Drew Emery, a local theater person and also the author of Hidden History, who volunteered to run the company and consolidate the debt. But unfortunately, the theater had to shut down in 1997 after being unable to afford to produce shows and pay off their debts and their actors. So that's a little history about Owlsby Theater. And Karen, do you want to run through a little bit of the history of the play?
Yeah. So like Challen mentioned, this play is called Hidden History, True Stories from Seattle's Gay and Lesbian Elders, written by Drew Emery and the cast. So basically the playwright Drew Emery and the director Patricia Van Kirk, with a team of volunteers, conducted over 40 interviews with Seattle's gay and lesbian elders, which in this case they defined as folks over the age of 50, and they were recorded and at least partially transcribed and collected by Special Collections. So from that, five oral histories were selected to be featured in this play, and the playwright Drew Emery wrote the following, quote, "As fresh and unique and individual as these voices are, it's been a powerful and comforting rush to hear a familiar echo or two. I suspect that these echoes are the collective reverberations of our species. The predominant view has been to look at history as a string of facts, events that can be cataloged, analyzed, and defined. To anyone schooled in the United States in the last century," and Drew Emery, side note, was writing this in 1992, "this view of history has been unavoidable. But maybe if we examine its shortcomings, we are better able to balance it with something a little closer to the truth." So that was Drew Emery's purpose for writing this play, was to find these hidden stories and undiscovered voices of Seattle's gay elders.
I really thought that the way that this play was created was really interesting, since it was from oral histories. And, you know, in last episode with Abby, we talked a lot about oral histories and the importance of them. So it's really neat to see, you know, what we can do with oral histories and how we can change them around and like create new art from them.
So now I think we're just going to run through some of the actors in this play. There were five of them, and they were all narrating their own stories. So they weren't necessarily playing characters, more like they were sharing their own life stories, just in a structured way. Okay, so this is what a version of the play published in 1992 says. Herdy C. Stiles is a registered nurse by profession. She moved to Seattle 5 years ago with her partner of 10 years. She is a mother of one son and two mini dachshunds. This is her first acting experience since she was cast as a dancing fairy in her fourth grade production of Peter and the Wolf.
The second cast member is Malcolm McKay. Malcolm was born in Marshall, Texas on April 21st, 1940. He studied theater and English and received a master's degree in educational psychology from the University of Texas at Austin. He is an actor, professor, therapist, sexologist, juvenile probation officer, guru follower, husband, father, and lover. And it also says, Malcolm is delighted and humbled to be a part of this company of incredible people.
Next, we have Margaret King, who was born in Friday Harbor, Washington on March 31st, 1929. She has three younger sisters and her parents are 85 years old. Margaret taught north of Seattle for 28 years and retired from teaching and coaching in December 1986. Since retiring, she feels a great freedom of my spirit. Margaret's sole theatrical experience was playing Harriet in her high school performance of Miss Jimmy.
And then the fourth cast member, which you might remember from our second episode, was Stephen Blair. Stephen was born in a sod house in Swanville, Minnesota on July 19th, 1917. He attended the University of Minnesota in Duluth, was a field paramedic for the United States Army, a medical assistant, and steward and ship's delegate on passenger liners and freighters. Stephen has extensive stage and screen credits, including South Pacific, Failure to Provide, Allergic to Love, and performances with numerous men's choruses. Stephen was also a coordinator for the 34th District presidential campaign and a Democratic delegate. I also just wanted to point out, I found this to be like a really fun one-off thing that Stephen Blair said in one of his oral history transcripts, was he was talking about Frank, his partner. If you don't know who Frank is, listen to episode two. So Stephen noted that Frank used to be the lover of Judy Garland's father.
Oh my God.
Yeah, which like brings a whole new interpretation to the friend of Dorothy term. Yeah, just wanted to note that too.
Oh my gosh, so important. Thank you for finding that. Okay, so our fifth and final cast member is Tamara Turner. Tamara Turner is a native of Seattle and a medical librarian. She has been a member of Radical Women since 1972. Her only previous experience in acting was a high school one-act play called Suppressed Desires. And I'm going to go a little bit more into Tamara because this time around I was looking at her papers. That was the Tamara Turner papers from 1931 to 2014. And I just got really deep into learning about Tamara. And so this information is pulled from multiple sources, including her paper's finding aid from UW Special Collections, an interview she gave, as well as her Wikipedia page. So yeah, she was born in 1940 on March 27th at 11:46 p.m. exactly, which is something the play references. She was the granddaughter of Walt Putney, which is only notable because he apparently was running with Butch Cassidy's train robbing gang, which is really cool. She was raised by a single mother and went to the University of Washington for history as an undergrad and then graduate school to get a master's in library and information science.
What?
So does that sound familiar or what? There are a lot of really cool facts about Tamara. One of them is that she was very political. She was asked in an interview like when she first started identifying as a radical. And she talked a lot actually about the McCarthy hearings, which were like going on TV when she was like a young preteen, basically. Tamara notes that, this is a quote from her, "The Rosenberg's execution combined with living in a household supported only by my mother, who had to make decisions about whether to buy food or pay for heat, convinced me that there had to be a more just way of arranging the world," end quote. So yeah, she got attuned to radical politics pretty early on. She mentions that, quote, "At the time, there wasn't any political group around that offered any positive program. When the women's movement started, lesbians were called the Lavender Menace, and some leaders tried to distance the movement from lesbians as quickly as possible. Then the gay movement started, but very quickly turned into a vehicle for the usual male prima donnas because it was sexist to the core. I was never fully attracted by lesbian separatism in any way. I wanted to have full rights in this society, not run off to the woods to play goddess. I had heard about this group, Radical Women, and went to a meeting. The political ideas changed my life because I found a place where for the first time I could be all parts of myself at once. And soon after I joined the Freedom Socialist Party." So she got involved in this group, Radical Women, and the Freedom Socialist Party, and pretty much stayed very active in both. And yeah, it notes that she was the first open lesbian to join Radical Women. And according to Wikipedia, Turner's work with Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party centered on not selling out the needs of those at the bottom, working towards broad radical leadership. And working with those groups, she helped add both sexual orientation and political ideology to this non-discrimination clause in the Seattle Fair Employment Practices Ordinance in 1973. On top of that, she did a bunch of work as a librarian, negotiating union contracts, and just generally like fighting for the worker. To wrap up Tamara Turner's biographical information, she passed away from leukemia on March 22nd, 2017 in Seattle, Washington. So another icon, rest in peace.
Yeah, it's neat that we, you know, got to like explore this play and the people in it through not just the LSB Theater records, but also through the records of two of the cast members who were actually in it.
Yeah, I definitely wish I could have gotten to know all of them so intimately, but it was really cool to at least get to see these two.
Yeah. Yeah, so now that we kind of ran through what LSB Theater was, like the beginnings of the play and then overview of all of the characters, We wanted to spend the rest of this podcast just kind of like book clubbing the script.
Yeah,
sadly, we cannot share this script because it is against copyright, but it definitely falls under fair use that we can pick out little snippets of it and share those with you.
Yeah.
Karen and I both were able to read through the script. Personally, I thought it was beautiful. I cried 4 or 5 mm-hmm. separate times during this hour-long play. I was feeling very emotional that day, apparently.
Yeah, no, I felt the same. I think that this play wrecked me, but in the best of ways. I wrote down that I felt like I was punched by it, but also like hugged. Just so much feeling was going on. It made me think, it made me, yeah, cry. It made me like, you know, think about my own experience and like kind of similar to what Drew Emery was saying, like, it was interesting that these people who are so very different from us and who a lot of whom have like since passed on, like a lot of what they were going through, even though it's super different, like resonated a lot. And it was really cool to be like, wow, I feel very seen.
What was like something that like really stuck out to you?
I'll just say I resonated a lot with Herdy's sections of the play. And one of them is the following. I'll just read this short paragraph. Part of the reason I didn't come out until I was 29 was that I had erotic dreams about women my entire life, and I never associated them with being lesbian. All the books I read at the time said it was absolutely okay for girls my age to have romantic and erotic thoughts about women. I thought I was normal, end quote. And then like later, she gets into like how difficult it was for her to come out to her mom, who she had like a really strong relationship with prior to coming out, but then everything kind of changes. So I'll also read a little bit about her mom. So this section again is Herdy speaking, and she says, "No matter how I look back at my life, it always comes back to one person, my mother. She's 85 years old and a mother of 14 children. She is a remarkable woman, and I've always had so much respect for her and the values she taught me. But one thing in particular made a deep impression on me. She always referred to us 14 as her blessings from God. So I grew up thinking I was a blessing from God. The most important thing she did for me is tell me on a regular basis, there is nobody on earth who is better than you. And I believed her. She always taught me to be just who I am. And that was as good as anyone walking on this earth needs to be." So this just really struck me about Herdy's mom calling her a blessing from God, because I think later some other narrators talk about how they had to overcome this feeling that they were, you know, born with this horrible burden, or like born wrong, or, you know, just somehow unnatural. And I think it's really important to highlight these moments, of joy, but also of just like, for each of these narrators, the moment they each kind of have a moment where they like realize that they're perfect the way that they are, and kind of take that into their own power and set it on their own terms. And for Herdy, she kind of goes through this roller coaster, because she starts out being really, really solid and validated by her mom, but then they go through some bumpy bits. So it seems like Herdy started coming out to people around her, but hadn't yet to her family. So she says, "I decided they love me. Tell them, just tell them." Now you have to understand, my mother is a strong woman. Take a good look at her. And she's holding a photo of her mom at this point. This is a strong woman. If there's a problem, she'll take care of it, especially if it concerns one of her blessings from God. So I decided I better write her. I said, "Mother, I'm writing this letter rather than telling you face to face, because I know how you are and I know how I am. And I know the kind of knockdown dragouts that we have. I want you to think about this before we talk, because I don't want either of us to say something that we may not be able to take back later." And I wrote, "I'm a lesbian. I was a lesbian the last 4 or 5 times you saw me." And I said, I'm telling you this because I figure I have another 40 or 50 years to live, and I don't intend to live it hiding from my family. So I want you to know who I am, because you don't know me, really, if you don't know this about me. So she comes out to her mom in this letter, and her mom basically flips out, I guess is the best way to say it. She tells all the relatives that they have to do something about Hurdy, that she's under someone's bad influence, that she just needs to come home, that this lesbian thing is basically just a phase as a result of Hurdy being away for so long from her family. She even says that it's from hanging around too many white people, and basically attributes all of that to like why Hurdy's heterosexual marriage falls apart, and just, you know, gets into this big spiral, and demands that Hurdy comes home. Hurdy says this went on for 4 years. She says in the play, "We had many bloody fights on the phone. I told her she was a liar and a hypocrite. I tried to reason with her. I sent her books, but it was as if she was suddenly a different person. At one point she said, 'You've always been my favorite child.' So now I felt like, because I tell her this, I'm no longer her favorite person. And I told her, 'I don't want to be your favorite person. I just want to know what you think has changed. What am I now that I wasn't 2 months ago?' And she says, 'Of course, it was very painful. It was my very first experience,' she says, 'in my whole life that my mother acted like she didn't love me.'" And so this kind of goes on for a while. And it does end in a way, because she talks about how much later one of her relatives is getting married, and Hurdy brings her, you know, lesbian lover whose name is Anne, and her mom finally meets Anne and actually has a pretty like positive interaction, telling Anne like, you know, "I've heard a lot about you. I'm very pleased to meet you." And Hurdy's just like gobsmacked, because like, who, like, what happened? Why is her mom suddenly seemingly a different person again? And she kind of concludes this story with talking about how she was talking to her mom over the phone, and she said, "I've been thinking back over my 85 years, and I was thinking of all the things I would have done differently. And the one thing I'm absolutely sure I wouldn't have changed for anything in the world is this. I would still have every last one of my children, and I would have them all be exactly who they are."
That's the line that got me.
Yeah, I know. It got me too. It's still getting me right now. I'm like, what are these feelings? But yeah, so it was super rocky, and I was so scared that it wouldn't end well. But I think that story just is a kind of common one, in the sense that I guess, fortunately or unfortunately, time is one of the factors that gets a lot of folks to come around, especially family members, when people have their coming out moment. Yeah, it was just so striking because of how strong her bond with her mom was, both before and after she came out.
Yeah, I think it really hit home with me too. The ending part of, you know, "I would still have every last one of my children, and I'd have them be exactly the way that they are." And that change from when Hurdy's mom before was saying to her, "You're not a lesbian. I don't have children who are lesbians. Mm-hmm. You're not my child." And yeah, having to go through, you know, that trauma, I guess, of feeling like you're going to lose your mom, mm-hmm. or just any family member for that matter. The thing that really stuck out to me was when Hurdy says, this is one of her lines, and she says this to her mom, "I'm prepared to give you up if I have to, but I want you to know what I think. I will not set foot in this town again without my lover. I just won't. You can have me. You can have me here. You can have me as your daughter. You can have me as anything you want. But you will have me and my lifestyle and my lover. It's just that simple." And I think that just like really resonated with me, because I don't know about like your coming out experience. But I definitely, before I came out to anybody, I, you know, was like deathly afraid of losing my friends and my family. And I you know, built this really, really strong wall up, you know, starting at like 14, 15, where, you know, I mentally prepared myself to chop off my family, you know? And I think it's something that's so common within the queer community, and people who come out, and having to accept this fact that like you might lose your family over this. And yeah, I guess it like really fucks you up. You know, having to be like, I don't know the outcome, but I know now that with or without my family, I will continue to live on. And, you know, having to like make that separation is so hard. And that ultimatum is so hard. But I think it's also completely necessary to protect yourself from that hurt and that pain. I think that really resonated with me because I went through that and hearing that, you know, these elders, my elders went through that as well. And they're all from very different backgrounds and identities. And it's, you know, a very common thing. And then I think, yeah, at the very end when her mom comes around. And I think that's also a very important lesson to know within, you know, for queer folks is that it takes time for people to adjust. And seeing how Herdy's mom, you know, went from unconditional love to like having this big hurdle and then realizing that like unconditional love is unconditional love was really, really powerful to me.
Yeah. No, I think you said it perfectly because, yeah, sure. Let's get into our coming out stories. I think, yeah, Herdy really appealed to me because she mentions that she comes out like a lot later in her life than when she like knew for herself. And kind of like you were saying, it seems like she went through this process of like, okay, here's the inner circle of people I'm going to tell first. And then maybe like over time, I'll include more and more people into it. And she also says like, you know, I've been coming out my whole life. Like it's kind of a process that never really ends. And I think for me personally, I'm still in that trying to expand my circle of people who I feel comfortable coming out to. And it's, yeah, very fraught because right now it doesn't really include my family that much. And it's just like, I almost want to send this, like if I could send this play to family members to be like, look, like being able to, yeah, see that like good outcome, I guess, and like have that to refer to as almost like a, I don't think it would be a shortcut, but I just would want to like show this to my parents and be like, so this is how it could go. And this is how I hope it can go. And I'm really, really hoping that it doesn't take as many years because it, yeah, it causes a lot of strife. But yeah, I think is why stories like Herdy's are really important to like amplify so that, yeah, we don't feel like we have to go it alone or do a lot of, yeah, disaster spiraling and think about that cutting off. Yeah.
Yeah, coming out's incredibly isolating. Being in the closet is so isolating. Because, yeah, you, like, this is, like, such a huge part of your identity and, like, how you see the world and how you're going to interact with it. And, yeah, not being able to tell anybody about it is hard. And I think that Herdy said it best where she was like, if you don't know that I'm a lesbian, you don't know me. You don't know who I am. And yeah, I found that line to be very impactful too.
Yeah, so big, I think from both of us, big like gratitude to Herdy because yeah, her story just like touched both of us so much. And I think I'll like continue to learn from it as I move forward in my own little queer coming out journey.
I have a little bit of a longer thing highlighted that I'd like to read. And this is from Malcolm's story. I guess a little background, you know, Malcolm said he was a guru follower. So this was during his time following a guru. He was a part of this tantra group in Pune, India. So he's sitting at the circle and they're talking And this is what Malcolm says. I crawled over in front of this guy, sat down in front of him, and said, I want to make love with you. And a shout came out of my head. I had no idea what I was going to do when I crawled over in front of him. And she said, quick, close your eyes, close your eyes, take a deep breath. She said, ask yourself the question, is his answer important? And when you know the answer to that, open up your eyes. And I opened my eyes and she said, is his answer important? And I said, no, his answer is not important. And the guy I'm talking to looked at me and shrugged and said, well, you know, I don't know. I go easy with women. It's very easy for me to get with any woman, but with men, it gets in my head and I get confused. And I sort of don't know who's got the elbows and arms, you know? And the group leader pointed to him and said, you just missed. And I looked at the group leader and said, he missed? And a woman sitting next to me said, I've never seen another man love someone so totally, and he couldn't accept your gift. You offered him a gift, and he said he could not accept the gift. And I said, gift. And it just came out of me with tears just screaming out of me, gift, gift, over and over, like it never occurred to me to see that as a gift. I've always seen it as a curse. That really got me going, and it's still getting me going. Because, yeah, it's, I guess, sad in a way to see somebody's sexuality and someone's, like, you know, positivity and radiance of love. And to look at that as a curse. Seeing how this moment for him was so impactful and hearing the word gift instead of curse just really, I guess, brought tears to my eyes. Because it was really, really pretty and just a gorgeous moment for him. And I think that was super transformative. And I'm very happy that he got to go through that.
I think what you're really liking about this gift moment with Malcolm has a lot to do with how I liked Hurdy's moment with Blessing. And Malcolm, much later in the play, actually near the end, has this moment where he says, the idea of being born in sin simply has to go. We are born whole and ready to go. We have everything we need to feel, to love, to sense, to learn, and to grow. It would have been nice to have an appreciation for my potential as a full human being from the very start. But watch me. I'll take what I've got now and run with it. And I think, yeah, just similar to how you were really feeling the beauty of the gift, I think this sums up the feeling that Hurdy and Malcolm both gave me of just like, yeah, like returning to just like very cosmically or elementally who they were and being like, I've wasted enough time like trying to fight this or trying to listen to what other people are saying about me. And now, like through my lived experiences, like I've decided to take charge and just go with what I've got as fully as I can. And it's really, I think, inspiring, and especially to us who I think we would still be considered queer youth. It's just really awesome to hear that wisdom come on down from these two very specific stories.
Yeah, it's very inspiring. You know, I think especially this past year, and past 2 years living in Seattle, I've been able to, you know, really grow as a queer person in my identity and really discover it and come to terms with it and realize that it's an asset rather than a deficit, and something that I should be proud of and unabashedly show, whether the people around me like it or not. Fuck them, you know. It's such a huge hurdle, but yeah, I think it's just really, really beautiful to see people overcome that, you know, not just for me and my own journey, but to see other people succeed and hear their life stories and see them be happy.
Yeah. I love how like I'm just like getting cozied up and like feeling very like warm and seen by this play and just like this conversation. But yeah, I think also the story from Malcolm about how this moment seems very spontaneous, this gift moment, he kind of just like is overcome and like blurts something. I think that also is just another way that, yeah, a lot of these coming out moments aren't really planned. It just happens. And like, it's kind of one of those things that you can't take back. But again, like, I think a lot of our media and our external forces have really said there's going to be negative consequences. But in this story, he puts it out there and the person leading him is just like, okay, close your eyes and like, feel it. Just like sit in what you're saying and like, tell me if it's important that someone else validates what you just said. And he was like, no. And that was like the moment of him realizing, like, at the end of the day, it's Malcolm that needs to validate Malcolm. And I thought that was just so good.
I have one for Tamara. Okay, yeah. So in this story that she's telling, basically her and her girlfriend, they want to go to the doubleheader, which is in episode 2, but she goes into this bar with this with her girlfriend, and she says this: I remember when we saw these two women sitting at a table, and they had brown paper bags over their heads, and they had drawn faces on the bags, and had cut out eye holes and nose and mouth holes. And Sue said, that looks possible. So we went over to their table and introduced ourselves, and they proceeded to talk with us and laugh and carry on without taking off their bags. Now, as strange and weird and funny as that was, I can understand the fear of these women had. Going out to a gay bar in the 50s, there was always a really strong feeling of terror. There was no feminist movement then. There was no civil rights movement. You knew when you went out, you could be stopped by the police at any time. And I was. The police were awful. I think I really wanted to pay attention to that one because I have this really great photo from the digital collections at the University of Washington that I think pairs really well with mm-hmm. this. And it was from this protest in the 50s or the 60s. And it was like Teachers for Gay Rights, I think is what the poster said, or their banner. And they walked in this parade, but all of them were wearing paper bags mm-hmm. because they couldn't show who they were. It was so sad, you know, to read that and see, you know, these women going out to a gay bar where they are with their community mm-hmm. And still feeling scared and uncomfortable and having to like hide their faces.
I think similar to that, the like hiding, even when you're amongst your own community, was something that Margaret talked a lot about in this play. And Margaret kind of spends a good amount of time in her childhood, like playing sports and like, you know, being one of the boys and kind of getting scolded for not being feminine or whatever. And I think it's a lot later when she is like, you know, a PE teacher, she kind of takes on this double life kind of. So I think similar to that paper bag image is just the difference between like her weekdays and her weekends. So I'll read a quick blurb from Margaret. So Margaret says, in the early 60s, I was teaching in Edmonds and we started going down to the Madison Street Tavern at 3rd and Madison. It was this little bar with a little dance floor. I thought I was in hog heaven. This wasn't like Aunt Peabody's. These women were all professionals. In fact, they were mostly all teachers because that was one of the few ways that women could make a living, to be a teacher or a nurse. That's how I started living two lives. I had my life at school teaching PE, and then on the weekends I would come to Seattle to be a lesbian. But come Monday morning when I'd go to work, I'd always think, oh my God, what if someone saw me there? And then she kind of goes into this headspace where she shares about, yeah, her paranoia over being like discovered and getting fired. So I think the paper bag thing is, yeah, I think a big sign of the times was just that there were huge repercussions for being completely who you were. And a lot of people had to compartmentalize, whether it was wearing a paper bag or keeping your work life and your you know, true life very separate from each other. And I think Margaret talks a lot about how she goes through some heavy times and like alcoholism even to get around this like dualism in her life that was really like keeping her unhappy and kind of running her life. And later she talks about how she has this fantasy about coming out openly on Oprah. And I just think that's a really good image of just going from being really, really worried and like, you know, denying left and right to like, I would love to go on national TV and like come out on Oprah. So yeah, just another character arc that was really awesome. But yeah, I think it's important to note, like you said, even at these historic bars where everyone around you was queer and doing queer things, it was still, the outside world was so huge on weighing on people's psyches, and it really changed how fully or not they could interact with each other.
Yeah, I really want to point out how much of a privilege like our generation, and I don't want to say the next generation because like they're what, 5 years younger than mm-hmm. I am, but you know, these teens who are on TikTok being 14 mm-hmm. and just being openly gay with their family. We have such privilege, you know, mm-hmm. being able to lead a life where we are authentically ourselves. And not having to have this, like, as you said, a duality between who we are and who we present. And obviously there's still a ton of work that we need to do to make sure that everybody can feel that way. But the fact that there are people who are very outward like that, and it's more common and more accepted, is a great step forward.
Yeah, related to that, Margaret has this really cool quote where she says, you can be 60, 80, 100, but what are you? You're just starting out. The planet has been here God knows how many centuries, but little old me, I'm still learning to crawl. The only thing you've got a shot at is being yourself. And if you're patient and forgiving, you can actually get pretty good at it. I really liked that quote.
Another takeaway that I liked is from Stephen. He says in this one line, 1935 was the low depths of the Great Depression, and I desperately needed work. So since I wasn't old enough, I lied to get into the army. They put me in the rifle company. I knew I didn't want to kill anybody, so I asked to be transferred to the medical corps. And they said, what? There's nothing there but cocksuckers and queers. But there I went nonetheless. 8 months later, I was thrown out. Even though I had committed no acts, they had decided that I was gay before I had. And then Stephen holds up a piece of paper. Here it says, I was a queer pervert. He displays two ribbons. This ribbon was ripped right off my uniform. This one was cut with a jackknife, and they cut the buttons off my tunic, and they threw these colors in the dust. Humiliated and destroyed, I was in jail when my father came to Missoula to see me. He had no idea where I was or what had happened to me until they said to him, your son is a pervert. He's a fruit. I wish you could have seen him recoil. I had seen men bullwhipped, but this was worse. The cruelty of the army was no accident. I was just a boy, and I was treated like a common criminal. When I got back to Duluth, I tried to kill myself. Two women came to my rescue, and my stomach was pumped. They saved my life. But having spent 20 years in the Catholic Church, I was still in a terrible state of denial. For a long period, I tried to prove my manhood by having sex with women, which was a cruel and unpleasant fraud. When I finally figured out you're being dishonest to these people and you're being fake, I finally woke up. And I really appreciated this, like, coming to terms, I guess, with himself, and not only, you know, thinking inwardly about his own queerness and discovering who he was and accepting that part of himself, but also realizing that, you know, not only did he need to come out for himself, he needed to come out to, like, not hurt women and, mm-hmm. like, the other people in his life.
Yeah, Stephen's whole arc of being so young and having to make these hard choices and getting just, like, torn up by the army, his father, I mean, himself, when he tried to take his own life, all of that was, yeah, really hard to read. But I think it brought to mind that a lot of, I think, reaction to how hard life is to also make yourself hard. And I think what's interesting to me is how once Steven like gains a little bit more life experience and finds joy in partners and just living life, and like later Frank, his story takes on a softness, which I really loved, because then it's like told from the point of view of these really lovely scrapbooks, these really beautiful moments, like all over the world. And I think that contrast between the like hardness that we adopt to protect ourselves and then the like ability to release and like feel things again is really a common through line. And Tamara actually talks about it, I don't think directly, but there's this moment where she talks about liking hands that stuck out to me.
I really liked that quote too. Yeah. I'm excited for you to read it.
Yeah. So Tamara says, when I was a young child, I remember thinking that the hands I liked best were hands that looked like they had done something, that had lots of lines, and to me, a lot of character. I didn't like little, thin, white, spidery hands and things like that. I didn't like softness. I could not afford to be interested in things that were vulnerable, or I would not have survived. Yeah, just this whole conversation about Tamara and also Steven experiencing really difficult moments in their life, but then able to bring it back and not just form a callus over it, but instead really examine it and like heal from it in a way that's not just like a pure like cutting off of that emotion, was really, I think, healthy and good for me to see.
Bringing it back to Birdie's story too, because she had to find hardness before she was able to be more soft, I guess. And, you know, there's always this stereotype with like queer people where we're all softies and we're weak. And yeah, this sort of, I guess, idea that, you know, has always been perpetrated about queer folks. Mm. But I think that, yeah, we are soft because we found strength in the hardness first, and we had to harden ourselves, you know, just like she did with her mom and having to go up and being like, you're going to love me and my lover, or you're not going to have mm-hmm. me, and having to go through all of that pain and that hurt in order to finally be able to open up to her mom and like have this great relationship where she was able to be vulnerable and loving, I guess, and put that risk out there. Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that vulnerability, you know, has a lot of baggage with it. And it comes with a lot of hard work and struggle that should be recognized. Recognizing and respecting that these are what people have gone through. And I guess celebrating the fact that like they've made it through and they're able to be where they are today. Yeah, and I think the final thing that both of us wanted to bring up was we want to read through the final page of this play because I found it to be very, very empowering and strong and beautiful. So yeah, it involves all five people. So I guess, Karen, if we want to like take turns with the lines mm-hmm. and then just sing the name before we say the line, that works?
Yeah, totally. Hurdy, this is 50. Trust me. Youth doesn't have a monopoly on sex or having fun or looking good or feeling good. I still feel really beautiful. I feel really sexy. I feel really sensuous. So take a good look. This is not different. This is 50.
Steven. And this is 74 and still counting.
Malcolm. And this is a father and a grown-up child.
Margaret. And this is a proud lesbian with 6 years of sobriety.
Tamara, and this is a radical and a librarian.
Malcolm, and this is you.
Tamara, and this is you 5.
Birdie, and this is you 10.
Margaret, this is you 50 years from now.
Stephen, we're counting on you.
And then they all say, good luck.
Oh, that just gets me.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I found this to be really, really powerful. And I think it really touches on like the way that archives can, you know, be spaces for queer joy and
mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah. Also discovering, you know, the histories of queer people mm-hmm. because a lot of it, you know, wasn't saved or preserved. And yeah, I just found like this section specifically so empowering for me to be able to look back on these oral histories, you know, because that's where this play came from, and see that this was written through oral histories and through this archival project. And the ending with all of them saying, and this will be you, like you are the next generation. We're passing the torch on to you, mm-hmm. and you'll be all right. Mm-hmm. And I think that just like really gets me, because yeah, it's really hard to like interact, I think, with the previous generations of mm-hmm. queer folks. Sometimes it's hard to reach out or like even, you know where to find mm-hmm. them. So yeah, even though like I can't really talk with Stephen or Malcolm mm-hmm. or Hurdy or Tavera or Margaret, you know, being able to hear their oral history through this play and, you know, find comfort and solace and strength in it, and having it end on such a positive note of pushing forward and looking into the future is really exciting to me.
Yeah, you make a great point about like intergenerational knowledge and connection being really important but really hard. I think a lot of people are extra aware of like, you know, if you're queer in a rural area, like you're probably gonna have trouble finding other queer people. But I think less visible is the issue of, yeah, like even if you're surrounded by queer peers, you know, chances are that they're going to be people that, yeah, they're just people that are your age probably and like don't have that history and like that wisdom. They're kind of all just, we're all just like struggling in it together and we still like learn from each other, but there's just, yeah, like I don't think I have someone like Steven or someone like Hurdy in my life right now. And yeah, I think that's what made this so powerful, is like even though it's only like an hour long and like a couple pages, a thin booklet, yeah, it's still like this huge, strong yet soft connection to something that is super hard to find otherwise. So the power of archives.
Yeah, the power of archives, the power of oral histories, mm-hmm. the power of preserving history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also like sharing these voices. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to be petty and say, super glad the UW didn't throw out this one.
Ooh, take. But yeah, but like also creating a platform, you know, too, mm-hmm. for these people. Yeah, I don't know if we've touched on this yet, but like the idea of own voices and mm-hmm. Being able to, instead of telling other people's stories, letting these people tell their own stories. And you know, it could have been really easy for, what's his name?
Drew Emery.
Really easy for Drew just to pile through all 50 or 40 of these oral histories, choose the best stories, and create a play that he wanted to create. But no, instead he said, I think these are, like, this is a diverse group of voices with a diverse group or history, and I want to create a space for them to share their own stories and let them tell their stories, not somebody else, not a paid actor or anybody mm-hmm. like that. I'm going to pay these people who lived through these experiences and had the courage and the bravery to share them with us and let them be on stage and do it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just that like co-creation, you know, it's not the director telling Tamara like, oh, the line should be said like this. Like Tamara knows how that line should be said because it's her yeah. line. Like I think that's so cool and like makes the play so much more rich and like, yeah, obviously genuine. And we didn't get into it too much, but I'm definitely going to link some cute cast photos, because a lot of my boxes from Tamara Turner's papers are just like ephemera from when they went on tour together. And there's lots of mm-hmm. pictures of the cast, and they did this performance like several times to a lot of like wide acclaim. And I'm just really glad, because like it's impacting us so much to just even read it, but like I'm just imagining like what it would have been like to see it when it was touring. Mm-hmm. And you know, unfortunately Alice B, like we said, had financial troubles. They even, I found some letters to Tamara that were like, so sorry we can't pay you this cycle, but we'll get to you next time, we promise.
I saw that with Stevens too.
Yeah. So like they were struggling, but I'm still really glad, like, yeah, in another universe, like this play would never have gotten off the ground, but like here mm-hmm. we are, it's in front of us and we can cherish it and thank it for what it's bestowed upon us. Okay, so we've reached the end of our book club and we're still sitting with a lot of feelings, but before we go process off the pod, we're gonna do a round of thank yous for our queer elders.
Thank you, Stephen R. Blair.
Thank you, Margaret King.
Thank you, Malcolm McKay.
Thank you, Herdy C. Stiles.
And thank you, Tamara Turner, for all of your vulnerability and strength.
Yes, so good.
Thank you. Woo!
Thanks for listening to episode 4 of Queer Air Season 2. Check out the description for links to the collections we reference in this episode. Thanks again to the University of Washington Special Collections for access to those materials. Opening sound effects are by Zapsplat.com, and music is Gravy by Poddington Bear from Free Music Archive.
And then Saw, I think, I just love gore and horror, so... but there's also a lot of queer subtext. You know, in the first one, it can be seen as like I don't want to say homoerotic, but like, you know, there's two guys in a bathroom just chatting it up by themselves, trying to figure out how to save their lives. That's pretty, pretty gay, I would feel, you know?
I agree.
Yeah. And then on top of it, you know, Jigsaw creates this weird cult, and there's a lot of chosen family and people from very, like, you know, tough backgrounds coming together and like working together to do bad things, but they're still together.
Wow, you heard it here first. Cults are just chosen family.
They're just chosen family. Yes, cults are just chosen family. Every cult is queer.
Full stop.
You heard it from me first. It's an official statement from Callan Raymond Wright.
Oh my god.